As Illinois voters head to the polls, we're sitting down with candidates for statewide offices today. J.B. Pritzker, the Democratic candidate for governor.
The state is a big aircraft carrier, so you got to turn it in the right direction, and then we got to propel it in that direction.
Plus, medical experts say that getting rid of unused pills is critical to fighting the opioid epidemic. We'll hear about an event this Saturday that's providing safe disposal of leftover prescriptions. And are you getting ready for Halloween?
Hello, who is this?
What's that noise?
Popcorn.
You making popcorn?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Oh, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
Well, if you're like Drew Barrymore there in Scream, we've got a ton of suggestions coming up for you later in the show, and we want you to join us on the air. Nominate your favorite Halloween films. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. November 6th is Election Day, and there are lots of statewide offices on the ballot. Here at the 21st, we've been interviewing candidates who are running for those positions: comptroller, treasurer, attorney general, and governor. Starting today and over the next week, you'll hear those interviews. You can also find them later at our website, 21stshow.org. This morning, we're sitting down with J.B. Pritzker. He's a Chicago venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and philanthropist, and he's the Democratic nominee for governor of Illinois, and he joins us from our partner station, WUIS, in Springfield. J.B. Pritzker, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Nyla. Great to talk to you again.
You know, I feel like I've talked to quite a few folks who say they have been turned off by both the amount of money spent on this campaign and, frankly, the personal wealth that both you and Governor Rauner have. And they wonder how someone like J.B. Pritzker can relate to the problems of a middle or lower income person in Illinois.
Well, Nyla, I've spent my life standing up for working families all across the state of Illinois and the nation. As you probably know, I've spent decades as a national leader in early childhood education, fighting for quality preschool and child care for our most at-risk kids. I helped to expand President Obama's No Kid Hungry program to 230,000 more kids in the state so they could get school breakfast. These are kids who wouldn't otherwise get breakfast in the morning. And, you know, I led the effort to build a museum that teaches more than 120,000 kids and adults to fight bigotry, hatred, and intolerance. I was the chairman of the Illinois Human Rights Commission in Illinois, which is the civil rights court where people bring their discrimination claims. And I founded 1871, which is the world's best incubator, and it's here in Illinois. 7,000 jobs have been created there and hundreds of companies. So I have real experience and bring that to the fore. But also, you know, I'm somebody who has fought for working families my whole life, and I think that's the important thing that voters are responding positively to.
Many of the people who are listening to this program live in the biggest cities outside of Chicago, across Illinois, and we've been hearing those residents share how concerned they are about growing the economies in their town. And I'm thinking specifically of a question we got recently from a student in Decatur who was worried about the economic state of his community. If you were elected governor, what would you be doing to invest in towns outside of Chicago?
Well, this is one of the very earliest things that I addressed as a candidate. I think it's very important that someone who lives in Chicago understands the challenges that people are going through all across the state of Illinois. And that's why throughout this campaign, I've probably spent more time with more people across downstate Illinois than any other statewide candidate in a long time. And we put forward from the very earliest moments of this campaign a plan to create jobs in central and southern Illinois, as well as in Rockford and other areas. It's been neglected by Bruce Rauner, my opponent. He talks as if he's from downstate, but he's from Chicago, and he's done nothing for downstate Illinois, where I understand that jobs are critically important. We've got to make healthcare more readily available and lower cost, and I put a plan forward for doing that. And then we've got to make higher education more affordable for people, and I put forward a plan for doing that, including allowing people to refinance their college debt at a lower cost so they can put hundreds and thousands of dollars back on the table. So downstate Illinois has been a real focus of our campaign. And I bet you if you add up the number of times that I've been in downstate Illinois throughout this campaign, that it eclipses virtually any candidate you can remember.
I know you're going to be in Rockford later today. We've got folks listening from Rockford right now. What would you say in terms of what, can you share some specifics about what you would do to create more jobs in Rockford?
Yes. So there are two things that I think we should be focusing on in Rockford, among many others, but I'll be talking about those today. One is that, you know, Rockford's got this terrific airport that provides a real economic development engine for that area of the state as well as for the city itself. So we should be doing everything we can to bring federal dollars from Washington, D.C. to help expand that airport, as well as to help build economic development and job opportunities around the airport. So that's going to be a focus of our efforts, our discussion later today. And I also put forward a plan for helping small businesses in Rockford and other cities across the state of Illinois. Small businesses create the vast majority of jobs. More than two-thirds of the jobs get created by people who start businesses and grow them. And we ought to have a governor who understands that. I've spent my entire career really helping people build small businesses into larger ones. And I know what it takes: capital, it takes technical assistance and mentorship. It's why when I built 1871, it's now become the number one business incubator in the world. And I think we can do that all across the state of Illinois. So Rockford is going to be a focus of effort in that regard.
You mentioned higher education, and I wanted to ask you about that as well, especially as we're thinking about higher education and our universities being economic engines in certain places. I'm thinking of Charleston in particular and the layoffs that happened at Eastern Illinois University. I know you've talked about funding our public institutions at a level that they were at a couple of years ago. Is that specifically what you would do, and where would the money come from?
Well, there's so much more that we can do than just talk about funding. But, you know, look, Bruce Rauner cut funding for higher education by 20% and proposed a 30% cut in higher education. And as a result of that, 72,000 kids have chosen not to go to school in the state of Illinois over the course of his term. And people talk about out-migration from the state. Well, guess what? Many of those 72,000 kids left the state to go to school. And when they leave, 70% of them don't come back. And those are our best economic resources that are leaving the state. And then they're also our kids. We should want them to be here. We've got great universities and colleges in the state. But when you cut funding from programs that kids want to go to, when faculty get laid off in a massive wave across the state as a result of Bruce Rauner's failures, we are going to lose ground. So we've got to put back the damage that, you know, and repair the damage that Bruce Rauner has done. And then we've got to do a couple other things: lower the cost of college debt by allowing people to refinance in a program that won't cost taxpayers anything. 12 other states have done it. We can put hundreds and thousands of dollars back on the table for many people, as well as to lower the cost of going to college by expanding the MAP grant program in the state. Those are all things that we ought to have been doing that we will now do when I win.
Let's talk about taxes for a moment. Right now, Illinois state income tax is 4.95% for everyone. And you've said repeatedly that should change, that higher income folks should pay more than the middle class. And I know that would require a lot of work on the Constitution and with the legislature. What would you do in the interim?
Well, look, we've got to balance the budget of the state. It's fundamentally not balanced. There's a kind of a structural deficit in the state budget today. For 2 years, we went without a budget because Bruce Rauner failed. And then a third year that he vetoed the budget and Republicans came together with Democrats in the legislature to override his veto. He doesn't really understand how to balance a budget. Here are the things that you need to balance a budget. Number one, you've got to look at, are there efficiencies in state government? Can we run government better? Can we invest in things that will actually lower the cost of government, like early childhood education or like prevention of diabetes in our Medicaid system or HIV testing and so on? All things that Bruce Rauner has done not a good job at. And then you've got to look at revenue. The best way to enhance revenue in the state, of course, is to create jobs. And under Bruce Rauner, fewer jobs were created during the same period of time that his predecessor had, and yet he called his predecessor a miserable failure at job creation. Well, Bruce Rauner has been a worse miserable failure at job creation. We could do so much better. So we can bring revenue into the state by enhancing. And then, I've advocated for the legalization of marijuana, which would bring $700 million, perhaps even $1 billion. That's my own estimate of revenue to the state, as well as creating jobs and production facilities and dispensaries to the state, as well as, of course, it brings some criminal justice reform benefits and safety for the public. So all those things, I think, you know, are ways in which we can help enhance the move toward a balanced budget that I want to bring to the state.
So would you keep the flat state income tax rate the same if it takes some time to change the Constitution to allow for a graduated income tax?
Well, it does take time to change the Constitution to a graduated income tax. The fair tax system would require us to get a supermajority vote in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, and then a supermajority vote of the people of the state of Illinois. So that takes almost 2 years. Meanwhile, you know, we still have to balance the budget, and we're going to work on that from day one. It's incredibly important for our state that we meet our obligations. Bruce Rauner's added $11 billion of additional bills to the state to a $16 billion bill backlog and cost the taxpayers $1 billion in late fees because he's the biggest deficit spender in the history of our state. We need responsible government, stable government, and that's what I bring.
My guest is J.B. Pritzker, who is a Democratic candidate for Illinois governor. If you're elected our next governor, how would you ensure that immigrants would continue to play a role in Illinois' economy?
Well, the immigrants here in our state are playing an important role, a positive role in our economy. Many are entrepreneurs. Many have created jobs in the state. Many are hardworking, talented people who are paying taxes in our state. And frankly, it's good for the state. So I want to protect our immigrant families from the attacks by Donald Trump in Washington, by the Republicans who fundamentally just don't believe in immigration. My family, you know, were refugees to this country. When our family arrived, you know, were given a place to live by a social service agency because they were penniless, had no place to live, were given a public education. Learned English at a public school, and then a public higher education as well. And our family's been extraordinarily fortunate. Frankly, I think everybody should have the opportunity to succeed like that. And I'm going to make sure that that happens. I'm going to protect our immigrant population and enforce the Trust Act and make sure that we don't, you know, allow Donald Trump to dictate what our values are here in the state of Illinois.
And what about for people who are here illegally? What else needs to be done in Illinois to resolve what should be a federal problem, which doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon?
Well, we certainly need to fight for comprehensive immigration reform. That will ultimately solve the problem. But here in the state, you know, we need to protect the immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented. Many families, by the way, are mixed, partially undocumented, partially documented. But many have gone underground because they're frightened. They're frightened because the federal government is under Donald Trump is you know, raiding, trying to send 11 or 12 million people out of this country. I think that's impractical. It's also wrong. And instead, you know, comprehensive immigration reform is the way to go, and enforcing the Trust Act, which will protect the residents of the state of Illinois.
A few weeks ago, you said you would pay back Cook County more than $300,000 in property taxes for one of your homes in Chicago. And this has been an issue throughout the campaign, how much you paid in property taxes. Previously, you defended this tax break. Why did you change your mind?
Well, I didn't change my mind. You know, what I was making sure was that there's no distraction from the real issues facing us in the state. The things that I've been fighting for, you know, have been about the kitchen table issues for most people in the state, and that's making sure that we lower the cost of their health care, lower the cost of higher education so they can send their kids to school, making sure we have vocational training in high schools, and creating jobs and raising wages. And those are the, I think, most important things to the people of the state. And so I just wanted to avoid any distraction. But the fact is that we did a renovation project, and we halted the project because we weren't sure if that project would be sold or it would be put up for rent. And then we restarted the project. We paid all the taxes that were assessed on the property. And frankly, this was a distraction by Bruce Rauner, who has taken 22 property tax reassessments on his own properties, including two for parking spaces that he owns. And then he's illegally taken three homestead exemptions in the state. And then he proposed raising property taxes on people across the state by $1 billion. He doesn't want to talk about any of that.
We just have about a minute left, so I just want to ask you our last question that we've been asking all of the candidates, which is that one of the jobs of the governor is to be a cheerleader for Illinois. How would you sell our state to potential residents and businesses?
Well, I'm really excited to do that because I know what's great about the people, about the state of Illinois. It's the people of Illinois. We have some of the most educated, dedicated workers in the entire world. That's very attractive to businesses for job creation and so on. Bruce Rauner has been bad-mouthing the state for 4 years. He not only bad-mouths it everywhere he goes in the state of Illinois, but then he leaves the state and invites other governors to go on TV bad-mouthing the state. I think you want somebody who's going to fight for Illinois. We've got challenges. We need to overcome those challenges. But meanwhile, the governor should be, as you said, the cheerleader. It should be the chief marketing officer for the state and talking about the great universities and colleges that we've got here so we can attract students, not drive them away the way that Bruce Rauner has. We should be talking about the quality of our workforce, which attracts businesses, not drives them away the way Bruce Rauner does. And frankly, we've got to make the state more livable in lowering the cost of health care for people, and that will, and lowering property taxes too. Those are things that will keep people in our state and keep them from leaving our borders. I'm really excited about the future of the state because we need to turn this aircraft carrier in the direction of putting Springfield back on the side of working families. And, you know, the state is a big aircraft carrier, so you got to turn it in the right direction, and then we got to propel it in that direction. Unfortunately, under Bruce Rauner, he's been propelling it and aiming it in the wrong direction.
That's J.B. Pritzker, who was running to be our next Illinois governor. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, publishers of New Media Futures, The Rise of Women in the Digital Arts. A symposium featuring these trailblazing women will take place on Friday, October 26th at NCSA, the University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Are you getting into the Halloween spirit? If the decorations aren't doing it for you, how about this? Oh, that's so creepy. That's the theme from the original movie Halloween. And if you're too old to go out trick-or-treating, maybe staying home to watch a movie is a great way to celebrate. There are lots of great scary films in the theaters, including a new version of Halloween. But where to start? Katie Reif is an editor at the AV Club, and she's here with us to share her favorites. Hey, Katie, welcome back to the 21st.
Hello, I'm happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
And for those of you listening, we'd love to hear from you what your favorite scary movies for Halloween are. Call us. Our number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. There is a scary movie for everyone, even me who hates being scared at the movies. Tell me what you like and why. You can also tweet us at 21STShow. Katie, we heard a little of the original Halloween theme there, and of course, there's a new Halloween. Jamie Lee Curtis is back. Michael Myers is back. And was the original Halloween, that was supposedly set in Illinois, right?
Yeah, Haddonfield, Illinois, which as far as anyone can tell is somewhere between Springfield and Chicago.
That's all, just somewhere between Springfield and Chicago.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Are fans still very excited about this franchise in terms of does it have kind of a cult following over the years?
Yes, absolutely. I think this film is getting a really great reception from the fans. What it does is, so the Halloween franchise is kind of notorious for starting off really strong and kind of trailing off as it goes along. Some of the later Halloween films have their defenders, but this one was sort of pitched as a return to form, and that's what it is. It ignores a lot of the later Halloween sequels, which got really convoluted in their mythology. It goes back to the basics of there is a woman named Laurie Strode who was a teenage babysitter in the first one, and now she's a grandmother. And her whole life has kind of been defined by this, you know, by this one night where she almost got murdered. And obviously she's got a lot of trauma from that. And the new film kind of touches on how that's affected her life.
Yeah, let's actually hear a little bit of that.
The boogeyman. All this hiding, all this preparation, it was for nothing. I mean, it took priority over your family. It cost you your family.
If the way I raised your mother means that she hates me, but that she's prepared for the horrors of this world, then I can live with that.
That's Jamie Lee Curtis there, Katie Wright, speaking with, I imagine, her granddaughter?
Yes, that's her granddaughter. Yeah,
okay.
Who's in high school in the movie.
So what did you think? You think this is, and how did this did really well this past week? Did it open this past weekend?
Yes, it did. And it was number one in America by a huge margin, about $50 million.
I'm not sure what else is out there at this time of year, though, right? In terms of comparison.
Well, you're starting to get into the early stages of Oscar season at this point. Before this, it was a lot of First Man and A Star is Born and Venom, which is kind of a summer movie that came out really late.
Okay. So we're talking about scary movies. We want to hear your favorite scary movies. The phone number to call is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. We had someone who commented on Facebook about how they were enjoying the Hitchcock series that's happening at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. Katie, when we think about waves, I mean, there's Hitchcock. There was, that's obviously at the beginning of this. For a while, there was sort of like the Blair Witch found footage style, then remakes of Japanese films like The Ring or The Grudge. Does Halloween signal kind of a nostalgia wave about what we're going to maybe see remakes of? Because I feel like they're remaking everything now.
Yeah, there are a lot of remakes happening right now. I would say Halloween is not the beginning of a wave so much as kind of the culmination of one. Horror movies there have been a lot of really strong horror movies over this past decade, really, but mostly over the past 5 years. And the whole thing's been building a lot of momentum. And Get Out winning an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay and Shape of Water winning Best Picture were kind of signs that horror is going more mainstream. And last year, It was a huge commercial success. And this year, Halloween is a huge commercial success. I think it's just kind of the culmination of something that's been happening for a few years now.
And so I think when we think about Halloween or horror, the genre is very wide. If we're thinking like, I'm kind of surprised to hear you put The Shape of Water into like the horror genre. I guess I would put it into more fantasy, kind of scary fairy tale.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you, but the general critical consensus was that it was sort of a sign.
Okay.
I personally agree with you, but.
So I wanted to ask you about another remake, actually. This is not as big of a blockbuster, but film buffs will be familiar with this. And I know this is something you really liked. Can you tell us about Suspiria?
Yeah, Suspiria is an Italian horror movie. It came out in 1977. That was Dario Argento, who's kind of acknowledged as the greatest of the Italian horror directors. And in the late 70s, early 80s, Italian horror was a very B-movie, kind of a little bit disreputable kind of thing. They would play at the Grindhouse, you know, kind of grimy theaters that used to be big in, you know, more inner city type of areas in the 70s before video stores came along. And so over time, Suspiria has kind of been redeemed as this like sort of art house classic of horror films because it's got this really distinctive visual style and a really cool score. And so Luca Guadagnino, who last year he directed Call Me By Your Name, which I imagine a lot of your listeners have heard of, he remade Suspiria this year. It's coming out next week. And he really went all the way into the art house realm with this. I think it's a really like bold, audacious horror movie. It's got Tilda Swinton. It's got Dakota Johnson and Chloe Grace Moretz. Tilda Swinton plays a dual role as a witch ballet instructor and also as an elderly male psychiatrist. She plays the part in prosthetic makeup. And it's just a really kind of bizarre, bold, crazy movie that I think is going to be pretty divisive, but I kind of loved it.
We actually have a little clip of it, Katie. So let's play it, and then maybe you can explain a little bit more about Suspiria.
I want to start work on a new piece. A piece about rebirths. The inevitable pull that they exert and our efforts to escape them. Susie, you will improvise freely at its heart. I'm interested in your instincts here.
That's Tilda Swinton in Suspiria. We're talking with Katie Reif, who's at the AV Club, about Halloween movies. What did you like about this, Katie? It sounds like that clip doesn't say horror film to me or scary film to me immediately, but things can be misleading.
Well, it's a type of horror film that I really like, which is I like movies about witches. I just think they're cool. I like the imagery. And this is a film about witches who run a ballet school in Berlin in the 1970s. And Susie, who Tilda Swinton refers to in the clip, is Dakota Johnson, and she's a student who comes to the school and is kind of a natural savant at witchcraft. Well, I guess what I liked about it is it's really, you could write a thesis about this movie. You could write a graduate level thesis about all the symbolism in it and all the, it's got a lot of references to politics and history. And it's just a really, I hate to use the term elevated, but it is, it's like high art, this movie, coming from what's basically one of my favorite films is an exceptionally well done slasher movie. But this is, I think, it's very self-serious in a way that I find kind of appealing.
We're talking about Halloween movies, and we'd love to hear any classics that you watch every year. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Kitty, I know we're supposed to be talking about movies, but since you mentioned witches, have you seen the new Charmed reboot?
No, I haven't yet. I've heard we've got an essay coming out on the site about it today that I'm really excited to read.
Yeah, there's only two episodes. I think I've only seen the first one. Or maybe there's more than two, but I've just seen the first one. I'm kind of interested. All right, you'll have to come back on and we will talk about what you think about the Charmed reboot. But to the point of, we've been talking about movies and we've been talking about movies in theaters. I wonder if we can switch to streaming titles. And
sure.
Let's start with Amazon Prime. What can people find there that you recommend?
Well, two films that are on Amazon Prime that I would recommend are, this is one that if you don't like horror movies, you still will really like this, I swear. It's not scary at all. It's called What We Do in the Shadows, and it came from Taika Waititi, who's the director that did Thor Ragnarok last year.
Which was surprisingly funny.
Yeah, and it's very much the same sense of humor. That's Taika Waititi's kind of droll sense of humor, and he applies that same kind of humor to vampires in this one. And it's a mockumentary about a group of these kind of like three bachelor vampires who live in an apartment together in New Zealand and have all these, like roommate conflicts and things like that.
And we've got actually a clip of this. This is a scene that's a meeting between the roommate / vampires.
You're a cool guy, but you're not pulling your weight in the flat.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that I'm cool.
And the other day, I dragged a man's body down the hallway and noticed that there was no dust. Like, I kind of swept the hallway.
Vladislav is just like this older vampire who grew up in the medieval times. And, to be living this long and to have seen the things that he's seen, he's a really great guy, a bit of a pervert. He has some pretty old ideas about things.
We should get some slaves.
Yes.
Oh, gosh, that does sound really funny. So that's What We Do in the Shadows, Katie?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like The Office meets vampires.
A little bit, yeah. A little bit of a take on that with the same sense of humor. And the other fellow you heard talking there was Jemaine Clement, who's half of Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, okay. Really interesting cast for that then. So in the more traditional genre, House on Haunted Hill, that's also streaming right now on Amazon Prime, right?
It is. It's free on Amazon Prime, and there's a colorized and a black and white version. I think you should watch the original black and white. Yeah, this is a classic. This is William Castle, who was big in the late 50s, early 60s, and was kind of known for his gimmicks. He did The Tingler, which was the movie where the theater seats would shake while you're watching it. And House on Haunted Hill doesn't really, it's not as gimmicky as some of his other films, but it stars Vincent Price, who I think is just one of the the loveliest actors to ever appear in horror films. Vincent Price was a very sophisticated guy. He was an art collector. He wrote cookbooks. He
was in Thriller.
Yes. He's a voice in Thriller. Exactly. And in this one, he plays a millionaire who has five people stay in his haunted mansion overnight. The thing about it is this movie may have been a little scarier when it came out than it is now, just because it's 60 years later. It's pretty tame, but it's still just got a lot of Vincent Price is so hammy and fun, and he very much plays the host like, welcome to my haunted mansion, and it's a really fun movie.
And this is the original, to be clear, that you're talking about, because there's been, at least one remake and maybe a couple, probably, right?
Yeah, there was a remake in the 90s.
Okay. I wonder if we think about, when we think about older movies, how scaring people in movies has changed. I mean, as we think about trends, like, are we thinking more of nowadays, I just saw A Quiet Place, which is, just mm-hmm. as a side note, not a good movie to watch on a plane, because I think the person next to me thought I was going to, was freaking out because I was scared by it. But that's very suspenseful.
Yes. Yeah. Well, to bring it back to Halloween for a moment, Halloween was a really big movie because it was one of a handful of films that came out in the late 60s and in the 70s that really revolutionized horror. So the big turning point was Night of the Living Dead, which came out in the late 60s. And before that, a lot of horror movies were more like House on Haunted Hill, where they were a little stuffy, a little proper, a little more gothic in the Victorian sense. And horror movies became a lot more, graphic.
I was going to say gory was the word I was thinking.
Yeah,
of.
Gory or graphic, however you'd like to put it. And suspenseful, that kind of intensity didn't really come in until the 70s and 80s.
And when we're thinking about scary movies or scary films, are there any good foreign scary films that you would recommend? I know there's been a lot of remakes. We talked at the beginning of American remakes of Japanese films like The Ring.
Yeah, there's two that I would recommend that are on streaming. One is called Train to Busan, which is a South Korean a zombie film that came out in 2016, and it's on Netflix now. It was a big hit at the time. It's just the basic concept is there's a train, an express train, and it's got zombies on it. And so it's a real contained kind of environment. But it's just a really well-done film. It's pretty scary, I'll say that. But that movie is heading for an American remake, and you can watch the original on Netflix before that comes out.
And when and then I wondered if we just have a couple minutes here before we end. I wonder if
sure.
we could talk about scary movies for kids that are kid appropriate. And I actually was thinking of one of my favorite scary movies when I was a kid, which is Gremlins. And we actually have a little clip of Gremlins, and we can talk about what age appropriateness Gremlins is for.
What is it, a birdcage?
No, don't shake it. We're going to have to open it now. It won't wait till Christmas.
What is it?
No.
It's your new pet.
Oh, isn't it cute? Has it got a name, Dad?
Yeah, Mogwai. I just call him Gizmo. He seems to like it.
Hey, you remember Gizmo? Gremlins is actually on Hulu right now, right?
Oh, yeah. It is. Gosh, I love Gizmo. Gizmo's my favorite thing in the whole world.
I wanted to have a Halloween costume of Gizmo, and it never worked out.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That would be so cool.
So Gremlins, this is a good one for kids nowadays, who maybe it's a good reminder that kids nowadays, this came out in 1984, so a lot of kids, obviously, mm-hmm. this is a good one for parents to introduce to their kids now, right?
I would say a little bit older kids, though, because the director of that movie, Joe Dante, he's known for kind of putting kind of a biting edge on things like Gremlins. And I'd say probably like 8, 9, 10-year-olds
right.
for that one.
That's
there's
a good point.
There's one monologue in it where Phoebe Cates describes a Halloween or Christmas.
Yeah, and that's pretty rough. We're not going to talk about that one on the air, but that, you're right. That makes, that raises the level of age appropriateness for Gremlins.
Yeah.
Katie, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us. We'll put up a list of all of these movies at our website at 21stshow.org. Yeah. Katie Reif is a news editor with the AV Club. Katie, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every day, millions of Americans buy and use prescription pain medication. And most of the time, they're taking these meds at the direction of their doctor. But as we know, even these prescribed medications can lead to addiction. Last year, more than 72,000 people died from opioid overdoses. And here in Illinois, that number is nearly 2,000. And those numbers are for people who died from both legal and illegal drugs. Lurie Children's Hospital and Northwestern Medicine are teaming up to try to address this. On Saturday, at six different sites in northern Illinois and in the Chicago area, they're offering safe places to get rid of extra prescription pills, and the goal is to reduce the risk of addiction. Dr. Jonah Stahlberg is one of the people leading that effort. He's an assistant professor of surgery at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Hi, Dr. Stahlberg. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about the opioid crisis, Dr. Stahlberg, I think a lot of people know that it's a big and it's a far-reaching problem, but I just wanted to focus on the prescription drug side of this, since that's the main goal of what you're organizing. I wonder if we can just start by reminding us how much the opioid crisis in this country has to do with prescription drugs.
Well, the prescription drug crisis in many ways was a precursor to what is now both a prescription drug crisis and, as you said, an illegal drug crisis with regards to opioids. And even in 2016, 215 million opioid prescriptions were dispensed in the United States alone. So it really is still a staggering problem. And I really appreciate you focusing on the topic.
And I wanted to ask you, before we get to what you all are doing, what hospitals like Northwestern and other doctors across the state and the country are doing, thinking about prescribing opioid medication. I'm thinking about, especially for people who have surgery, sending people home with a couple dozen pills when maybe they only need like a dozen. Is that culture changing, you think, in the medical community?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the many initiatives that we're taking across Northwestern hospitals and then spreading to hospitals across the state of Illinois is decreasing the number of pills that are given to a patient at the point of discharge. Our latest data really shows that in 2016, about 80% of the pills within a given prescription after surgery went unused for the initial pain episode. And so we really do have a long way to go in decreasing the number of pills while still adequately treating patients' pain. And that message has to get out there.
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, I'm thinking about, I had a surgery last year and I remember getting so much of these pills and then also then the problem after. I didn't use it. And then you worry about leaving them around. And I guess that's the where we're at today with the conversation we're having with you about these pickup sites. What are people supposed to do with the extra medicine, assuming that they want to keep it in a safe place and they don't want someone who would, they don't want to create a situation where someone could get their hands on it who shouldn't be?
Yeah, absolutely. So the story you just articulated is one that we hear over and over again. So you are absolutely not alone. Many of our patients take the medications appropriately, and then they have leftover pills and they don't know what to do with them. And they end up sitting around in a cabinet or sitting in their glove box in their car until they can find out what they can do with them. And that's one of the purposes of the DEA Drug Take Back Day, is to raise awareness about the right ways to dispose of the medications and to make disposal easy. So this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. across the country and across the state, and the DEA will be helping to sponsor Drug Take Back. We will be hosting sites, as you said, at all of our Northwestern hospitals, but there are also sites all across the state of Illinois. And it is both to give a time window when people can throw away those medications, but it's also to raise awareness about the issue. So if you can't do it between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. on Saturday, NM and other hospitals and the DEA have tried to make finding locations for throwing away the medications easier. So you can go to our website, which is nmnorthwesternmedicine.org/safe-med-disposal. And that should be an easy website to remember. And then you can go and find it, and it'll tell you these are locations, either pharmacies or hospitals or places that have now set up drug disposal kiosks to make it easy for you to throw them away.
And why is it a bad idea to throw them in the trash? Or, well, I think a lot of people used to flush things down the toilet. Why is that not a good idea?
Sure. So it's not a good idea to throw them in the trash because actually there are lots of reports of individuals going through trash to get those medications and to abuse them. They also end up in our landfills and pollute our land. The same happens when you flush them down the toilet. They are not good for our water supply and water systems, and the EPA does not recommend flushing them down the toilet.
So how do you all properly dispose of them? What do you do with it?
So the best way to dispose of them is incineration, and we actually partner with a group that incinerates it. And so we offer what is called reverse distributor licenses, which is a fancy way of saying we not only can give the medications to patients, but we're allowed to take them back. We also have a whole program through Northwestern where we help other hospitals and other pharmacies figure out how to change their license so that they can be a reverse distributor and they can offer that service to their patients as well, because we feel it's incredibly important for the public's health.
Dr. Stahlberg, what kind of medications are you going to be accepting at this take back? Because not just, I imagine, we've been talking about opioids in particular and prescribed pain medication, but I imagine you'll be accepting, there's some things you will be accepting and some things you won't be accepting as well.
Yeah, so thank you for bringing that up. While the day is really to raise awareness about the opioid crisis and the appropriate disposal of opioid medications, we actually will be accepting any medications that you have laying around in your medicine cabinet, but we cannot accept liquids and we can't accept sharps. So with those two exceptions, any medicines that you have in your medicine cabinet that perhaps are expired, that are still sitting around, you're welcome to bring them by. We don't go through and count pills or even look at really what's going in there. All we care about is that they get out of the community, get out of your house and your home, and they are disposed of safely.
And so by sharps, you mean needles or things that have...
Yes, exactly. I mean needles. Folks who inject insulin or after surgical procedures, sometimes folks are given needles and syringes to inject medications that help prevent blood clots and things like that. So those can't be accepted. We can't accept sharp needles.
And I know the purpose of this is to educate the public about how medications can get misused. As we think about that, I wonder if there are some important things you want our listeners to keep in mind when we're talking about this issue?
Absolutely. So 115 people die from overdose every day, as per the most recent statistics. And while we think about in our heads that folks are really dying from abusing, as you said, either street drugs or illegal drugs, a large proportion of those are still from abuse of prescription drugs. And quite honestly, there's a good proportion of that which are accidental overdoses. And so it is really important, if you're actively need those medications, if you're someone who's on chronic opioids or you still need the medications after your surgery, that you keep them in a locked and safe place away from children, away from elderly patients. Make sure they stay in the childproof container that they come in, so that when we have these many medications just around in circulation, you can imagine not accidental overdose is a problem as well as intentional misuse leading to overdose.
That's Dr. Jonah Stahlberg, who's an assistant professor of surgery at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. One of the people leading this effort, as we've been talking about this Saturday in the Chicago area. But Northwestern has on their website where you can give back medications all across the state. So we'll tweet a link out to that. We'll have it up at our website at 21stshow.org. I know that, as he's saying, you can accept this at all of the different Northwestern locations in Northern Illinois and the Chicago area. I know there are plenty of other places in including like the DeKalb Police Department that are going to be accepting this medication. So we'll have all of that at our website. Dr. Stahlberg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you've ever gotten a call or even a knock at your door from someone claiming to be the electric company, you might want to take a minute to look for any red flags, especially if they're saying that your bill is overdue and you need to pay it right now. Ameren, Illinois says that since 2014, scammers have contacted more than 4,000 customers and gotten away with nearly $140,000. That's why they're reaching out to people across Illinois to let them know what to look for and how to protect themselves. Scammers like to target senior citizens, people who don't speak English, but even if you are a savvy customer, they say you're not immune. Stacey Young is a supervisor with Ameren, Illinois' Community Relations, and she's with us in our studios in Urbana now. Hi, Stacey. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So I think many people might have encountered this in some form or another, but you're talking particularly about in-person scams. What are some common ones that people need to be careful about or what you are seeing happen out there?
Nyla, what we are referencing is utility scams, which are more common than some may think. When they're being contacted by phone by a party that's saying, representing themselves as an Ameren, Illinois representative, and they're stating that, demanding that services be paid immediately in order to avoid disconnection of them. That's the type of scam that we're seeing that we were out speaking to local businesses on last week in regards to. There are certainly other third-party supply tactics that are going on that we can talk about as it relates to marketing tactics to get customers to switch their electric over to different companies. So two kind of separate issues there.
Right. So on the first issue, how does Ameren contact people when they're getting to the point of shutoff? How is the communication supposed to happen?
Ameren Illinois will send our communications by mail to customers if there's a need for them to respond to us regarding service interruption.
So you don't call people?
So we do not proactively give folks a call regarding that.
And you don't show up at people's houses ever?
No, we do not.
Just to be clear.
Not without a scheduled appointment.
And so is there, if someone contacts you and says they're Ameren, just in that itself, should that be a clear giveaway that it's not Ameren? Or are there other giveaways that there are people who are pretending to be you guys?
There are certainly some red flags that we ask our customers to look for, Nyla. If they are threatening immediate disconnect of service, if payment is not received immediately, that is not an Ameren Illinois proactive phone call or a tactic that Ameren Illinois would use. So if you receive a call, definitely that's a red flag that's likely unscrupulous and that's likely a scam. Unsolicited requests for personal information, such as your social security number, or if we're calling you asking you to give us your bill account number, those are definitely red flags because those are, again, not actions that Ameren Illinois would take. Whenever we need to notify our customers, we are doing so by mail and asking them to respond to us. And then, of course, suspicious recordings or when folks are saying, these callers are saying, can you go put this money on a green dot card and give me a call back? Those are all red flags that's not something that's coming directly from the utility company.
Stacey, do you think the scammers have gotten more savvy or sophisticated lately? I wonder if there's some new techniques they're trying that people need to be aware of.
Yeah. So while it may seem at first glance that, that's obvious that it's a utility scam, they are actually getting pretty tricky. And they are using different softwares. They're calling from local phone numbers. And then they're recognizing that if they can call a small business during high peak business times and get them rattled, that they're likely to yield a higher result or likely that these small businesses will go out and fall for the scam.
So it's not just residential customers. This is happening with commercial customers as well.
That is correct, Nyla. It's not just residential customers. We're seeing small business customers impacted as well.
And so, Stacey, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask, if someone feels like they're being scammed, what's the best thing for them to do?
If someone feels like they're being scammed, then what they would need to do is call 1-800-755-5000. Ameren Illinois will record that request. We'll turn it over to our security team, and then we'll let the caller know if we need to pursue that further with law enforcement.
So there's a phone number that Stacey just mentioned. We'll have that at our website as well. If you didn't have a chance to jot it down, if you just head to 21stshow.org, we'll have that up after the show. I want to thank Stacey Young, who's a supervisor with Ameren Illinois Community Relations, for being with us to let us be on the alert for all of this. Thanks, Stacey.
Thank you, Nyla.
That does it for us today and for this week. Next week on the 21st, we're going to continue talking to candidates for statewide office leading up to the November 6th election. We're also going to start tackling some of the important issues to Illinois voters every day next week. We'll be looking at health care, immigration, gun violence, and telling you where this candidates stand on this issue. We've also got voter guides for you on our website. If you head to 21stshow.org and look over to the right, you can fill in your address and find out your ballot and who will be on your ballot. And we're compiling all of our candidate interviews there, too. If you want to hear, for example, our interview we did this morning with candidate J.B. Pritzker, you can go to 21stshow.org to find it. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And on our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. Again, if you just remember our website, 21stshow.org, that's got all of our information. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.